And according to the court transcripts, Tsar Rubina brings up the issue, like, what is criminal about doing, like, cultural issues? Like, if I'm, you know, advocating for Russian cultural diplomacy, and I'm talking about the historical ties between Russia and America, and I'm talking about promoting Russian culture, where does that cross the line to being, you know, a foreign agent activity?
That's an excerpt from today's interview with RFARL journalist Mike Eckel about his recent investigation into the curious case of Noma Tsar Rubina, a 35-year-old Russian woman and mother of a young daughter who was jailed in Manhattan last December after a bizarre, honestly quite depressing meltdown led her to harass an FBI agent, sending him scores of drunk text messages and photographs, teasing him about prostitutes and spies. Tsar Rubina was first arrested in November 2024 on suspicion of repeatedly lying to the FBI about her interactions with Russia's main domestic intelligence agency, the Federal Security Service, or FSB. Prosecutors later added charges of transporting women around the New York region for prostitution and lying on her U.S. immigration application. Tsar Rubina has direct ties to a woman named Yelena Branson, whom U.S. prosecutors have accused of working as an unregistered agent of the Russian government. Their story recalls other alleged and confessed agents of Moscow who have come to the United States, such as Maria Butina, Natalia Berlinova, and Alexander Ionov. Now, that's a lot of names, I know. And you don't need to remember all these people's life stories, but there is what I think is a nagging question in the background here that I invite you to consider. When does networking and cultural promotion cross over into something pernicious and maybe even illegal? Some of the people who listen to this podcast probably work in similar fields, so the issue isn't merely academic. Welcome to The Naked Pravda. Howdy, folks. I'm your host, Kevin Rothrock, and welcome back to the podcast. I don't know if you can hear it in my voice, but I'm getting over what I can only assume is the bubonic plague. I don't know. I recorded the interview you're about to hear last week, and then I promptly died before I could edit and publish the audio. As I said at the top of the show, I spoke to RFARL senior international correspondent Mike Eckel, welcome back to the show, about his January 28th investigation, the FSB lies and drunk texting the FBI, the curious case of Noma Tsar Rubina. Check the show notes for a hyperlink to the article. And I had the interview planned to come out just after Mike's story was released, and it was going to be beautiful. And then, boom, a fever of 102 in Fahrenheit. I don't know what that is in Celsius, but it was painful, folks, in Fahrenheit and Celsius. Anyway, I'm alive again, mostly, and here we are. Finally. Obviously, like, Russian agents in the United States trying to influence things is nothing new, but we're kind of getting this trend of a parade of fools or something. Like, they're all kind of silly, it seems. And obviously, being sent to jail, there's nothing silly about that. But there's some comedy here in their behavior. Can you walk me through this group here?
One of the things that fascinated me about this case with Noma Tsar Rubina is that it fits a pattern, like you're talking about, of people who have popped up in the public eye, mainly due to criminal indictments of one sort or another. And there are commonalities between all of them, but there are also some important distinctions. There are criminal commonalities, like legal commonalities, and there are personal overlapping commonalities here. The crucial difference with Tsar Rubina's case is it's important to note at the outset, is that she was charged not with being a quote-unquote spy or being an unregistered foreign agent, but with lying to the FBI about her work, alleged work, for the Federal Security Service, for the FSB. The other people who fit into this pattern that I mentioned in the investigation are...
Sorry, can I just interrupt you real quick? Is the only evidence we have that she worked for the FSB or had dealings with them? Is it from her, or is there other? I mean, I know that she's connected to like Branson, who does face direct charges, but like, are we aware of any documents or some kind of evidence that proves her FSB connection?
Well, so let's say two things about that. One, most of the evidence comes from the court record. It's pretty voluminous, FBI affidavits, transcripts, charging documents, and the like. One of the important things that ties Zarubina to Branson is the fact that, according to the FBI, the search warrant that they initiated in order to seize Zarubina's phone and search it derived directly from the search warrant that the FBI used to search Branson's apartment in September 2020. And the FBI has made clear when they went in, and Branson has made clear publicly in her interviews, that the FBI went in and they seized like 36 electronic devices, computers, phones, iPads, iPods, who knows what else, thumb drives, and 8 different electronic addresses. I don't know if that only refers to emails, but also perhaps social media accounts, whatnot. And I believe there were quite a few cell phones, as I mentioned there. So the point of this is that the search and the criminal case that was initiated against Zarubina derives directly from the criminal case, the criminal investigation that they initiated against Branson. To your original question, what else do we know, or how else, what's the evidence tying her to the FSB? It is primarily, overwhelmingly, the charging documents and the related materials in the court record. It's also from Zarubina, who admitted to having contacts with the FSB. And then over the course of 4 or 5 interviews with the FBI, basically changed her story about who she was talking to and what her relationship was with these guys back in Moscow and Tomsk.
And so how does she compare to the other characters that you mentioned in your story, these people who have been charged with, acting espionage light, as you say, and I think the charges is very little bit, but there's a handful of people that come to mind when discussing her case. Like, where do they fall in this constellation?
Before I answer that, let me just also say there's other material related to Zarubina that hasn't come out in public yet, mainly because it's hard to corroborate and prove. There's a lot going on behind the scenes over this period of time, obviously before she was charged and arrested in 2024, and then, of course, in December 2025, when she was had her bail revoked and she was thrown into jail. So there's other material out there that may come out in the course of the court proceedings. It may come out due to the diligent work of investigative reporters. But the evidence is not only based on what the FBI has provided so far in the court proceedings.
I see. I was just wondering if, like, it's possible she's built herself up as somebody she isn't, because she seems a little bit unbalanced at times.
I don't see any indication that she's somehow exaggerating in any ways. And again, some of the material, some of the information, evidence that has not come out publicly yet strongly points to corroborating evidence to the her connections with the FSB. To your original question, now, again, Zarubina was charged with lying to the FBI, which is categorically a different crime than being an unregistered foreign agent or violating the Foreign Agent Registration Act.
Which one is worse?
So, I mean,
kids listening, don't do either one, please, but which one is worse?
Don't do either one, or don't do, just like outright, espionage. I mean, the Espionage Act is the big mother of all charges in this regard, and that gets used very rarely. The espionage light charge has been used more frequently in recent years, since 2016 or so, when Russia and concerns about, infiltration and hacking and manipulation of the U.S. political system came into the forefront. That's been used more often. Yeah, as far as what's worse, I'd have to go back and look at the statutes about, like, potential prison time. I'm not
okay.
sure exactly.
All right, so she lies to the FBI. Her colleague does something else.
Correct. Her colleagues, Yelena Branson, first and foremost, did something else. The charges that Yelena Branson faces are that she spent close to a decade running this cultural organization in New York out of her Manhattan apartment that was essentially allegedly parroting Russian government messaging on all sorts of things, and then the effort was funded directly by the Russian embassy, and that she actually allegedly reached out directly to Vladimir Putin to seek help for her efforts in New York. So that's where the unregistered foreign agent charge derives from. Now, the connection between Branson and Zarubina is also a personal one. Zarubina and Branson's daughter are reportedly close or have a personal relationship. And Branson is the godmother of Zarubina's daughter, who is in the United States.
Do we know where Zarubina's daughter is now that she's in jail?
I believe she's in Texas with relatives, perhaps, but It's not a...
Your story says that it's unclear why she went to Texas in the first place, but it's the assumption is relatives?
The assumption is relatives, and it may have to do with the father of the daughter,
who is
not central to the story, and the best that we can tell is not like a secret Russian agent or anything like that. He's secondary.
Or he's a much better one.
Perhaps.
Okay. And then how do these characters compare to people like Butina and Iona, of these other folks that you mentioned?
Well, it's, you know, again, with the other people mentioned in the story, there's Natalia Berlinova and there's Alexander Ionov. And they were both doing different things, different information operations, I guess, or different disinformation or manipulation operations. I don't know what the term would be. But in Berlinova's case, she set up this public diplomacy, creative diplomacy organization in Moscow, and then for years hosted an annual event that drew young professionals, graduate students, journalists, think tankers, aspiring academics to Moscow. And ostensibly they went to meetings and workshops and toured around the city and met important people and heard lectures. And it was under the notion of public diplomacy, like, okay, people need to hear what's going on in Moscow, so let's go talk to the foreign ministry. So on its surface, it's all very normal. It's what diplomats do around the world, either formally or informally. But in Berlinova's case, according to the charging documents, the court records, she was coordinating this effort with a particular division from the FSB, and was actually passing information on the participants in these events to the FSB, and then receiving instructions from the FSB to say, here's this guy, Kevin Rothrock, we want you to talk to him and find out where he stands on the question of Crimea, Krimnash ili Ninash, you know, and so she would work with the FSB to, the FSB would guide her about who she should talk to. And again,
What's the end game with that kind of stuff? Is it just to know who your friends are, or are there more diabolical uses for this information?
Before I answer that, the interesting thing, or overlapping thing with Berlinova and Ionov, is that allegedly the two individuals shared a pair of FSB officers who were their curators, their overseers, the guys who were then giving them instructions and guidance and money in some cases to do what they were doing. And again, for the listeners who don't recall exactly, Alexander Ionov is this anti-globalization, anti-colonialist character in Moscow who's very nattily dressed and is very tall as well. And he worked for years with activists in Florida, Black African nationalists, and with secessionists in California to promote these kind of, one might say, fringe political movements. And he was doing so, allegedly, at the explicit guidance and advice of the Federal Security Service, the FSB. What is the end game for all this? You know, in the case of Berlinova, I mean, it seems like, you know, the FSB was looking for people that could either, you know, lines of communication could be opened with them. It could be like career guidance. Like, for example, let's say Kevin Rothrock is identified as somebody who is sympathetic to Russian views, and then Kevin Rothrock.
I don't know if I like Kevin Rothrock as the example in all these all these scenarios.
All right, well, can you use somebody else? let's use me then. Okay, is that better?
No, Joe Schmo. I don't know. John Doe.
Okay, fair enough. You know, let's say John Doe goes on this participates in this forum in Moscow with Natalia Berlinova, and John Doe is sympathetic to, you know, Russian positions on Crimea or the Middle East or NATO, for example. And then John Doe goes on to be, say, a professor at Johns Hopkins in Washington, or joins the State Department, or, you know, or joins the White House down the road. You know, then there's potentially a line of communication that can be exploited years in the future by the FSB for one thing or another. So, I mean, it's a long game they're playing.
We know that Zarubina is from Tomsk. She's recruited, as I understand it, by a local officer there. So in terms of long game, like, not only is it a long game in the American direction, but even going backwards, like, there, it seems like there's a real kind of like farm system for this. Is her FSB pipeline, is it sort of common, or is there anything unusual about how she came to this?
You know, I can't tell exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's the FSB officers that we know from by name in some of these cases are all Moscow-based. So the Tomsk connection is definitely an interesting angle to it. I'm not sure if it's anything beyond the fact that, you know, that they knew each other. They were both not classmates, but they were, you know, Tomsk compatriots.
You develop the people you know, I guess.
Yeah, and when you see that there's a person who's, you know, particularly, I don't know, dynamic and charismatic and capable of networking, and oh, look, she goes to New York and she's very good at what she does and her English is excellent and she's making friends and she's posting selfies with journalists and Russian opposition activists, and, you know, then it's a long-term relationship. It's a long-term process of working with this person to get them to talk to the people you want them to talk to.
What do you make of her kind of unusual behavior? I mean, it seems to be the very thing that got her in jail. I mean, it seems like quite a drastic measure to put her in jail when she has a small child. There's the kind of like nonviolent nature of her transgressions, but then like she's writing these bizarre, drunken messages to these FBI agents, or maybe it's one FBI agent or several of them, but like not only on one occasion, but like even after being warned essentially in court, she does it again, as I understand it. Do you chalk this up to either like substance problems or just kind of she just has a strange sort of mind, or what do you make of it? Obviously, you're not a psychiatrist or psychologist or whatever, but I mean, this is definitely part of the hook, I think, of her story, is that she's doing some pretty weird shit.
Definitely, and that's what sets it apart from the other cases, because not only, I mean, she's charged with a different set of charges, lying to the FBI about her FSB interactions, but also there's this additional sideshow where during the period that she was charged and released on bail, that she then proceeded to multiple times violate court orders and warnings from prosecutors, a warning from her probation officer, a warning from her defender, don't do this, don't send the FBI messages. And the easiest explanation is the simplest explanation, which is what her federal defender, her court-appointed defender, told the court in September or so. The lawyer said, listen, she has a drinking problem and she needs to go for mental health counseling and go for substance abuse counseling.
And does she get that from the United States, or?
She does, indeed. At one point, in fact, in the bail hearing that took place on December 2nd, and again, the impetus for the hearing on December 2nd was that she had failed to heed multiple warnings, and the prosecutors got fed up with it all, and they went back to court and asked the court to revoke her bail. And the transcript of the hearing, which we obtained and which is actually kind of the heart of the investigation that we published, makes it clear that her probation officer, her lawyer, you know, they're sympathetic and they're like, listen, she needs to get help, but she just can't help herself. At one point, it says that she's seeing a therapist twice a week, and the judge who's overseeing this case is sympathetic as well. And she's like, you know, we've given you multiple chances, and you can't do this. You can't be texting an FBI agent at 4 o'clock in the morning, pictures of yourself with a big glass of red wine, talking about spies and prostitutes and that sort of thing. So the court seems sympathetic to her mental health issues.
Are there indications of how you expect her case to end, whether it's the verdict or whatever she does with her life? Because in the other cases, the suspects or the defendants or the convicts have gone back to Russia, but she is still in the United States. I mean, her case is still ongoing. Do you have any idea of what's in store for her when this is resolved one way or another?
So her trial is scheduled to begin in June. So she's in jail in Brooklyn, probably, until that time. You know, something could happen in the interim, of course. And yes, in the other cases, let's revisit. So we have Maria Butina. She served 15 months in jail after pleading guilty to being an unregistered foreign agent. Then she was deported back to Russia. Yelena Branson, she fled the country a month after her apartment was raided by the FBI and all her devices seized. And then she was charged a year or so later with being an unregistered foreign agent. Berlinova, she was in Russia already when she was charged. Ionov, he was in Russia as well. So Zarubina, it's hard to say what would happen. Possible she could agree to provide more information to be more cooperative with the FBI, with the Justice Department. And the fact that she has a daughter who is a U.S. citizen, that kind of is another wrinkle to all this. They're not going to separate the mother from the daughter to ship Noma back to Russia. But by the same token, one of the charges she faces is lying on her immigration forms, which is a somewhat serious felony.
What did she lie about?
I believe she lied about, they charged her with lying on about her past work with the FSB. So, I mean, that's, I don't know if that's a quote-unquote deportable offense, but, you know, immigration being what it is, as an issue.
Yeah, if it is, then that's a bad time to make that mistake.
I mean, they deport people for seeking political asylum these days.
Right.
So.
Right.
So Zarubina worked for Yelena Branson at Branson's organization was called the Russian Center in New York. And it should be noted that Branson allegedly did some other interesting lobbying activities. She was involved in communicating with government officials in Hawaii about historical Russian landmarks out there. And so her case is kind of interesting for its own reason. So Zarubina worked for Branson for a little while after Zarubina moved to the United States. And at one point in her conversations with the FBI, she was interviewed voluntarily by the FBI once, possibly twice, and then she was interviewed involuntarily, which is more serious. And in one of the involuntary interviews, there's discussion about her work for Branson with the Russian Center in New York. And according to the court transcripts, Zarubina brings up the issue, like, what is criminal about doing, like, cultural issues? Like, if I'm, you know, advocating for Russian cultural diplomacy, and I'm talking about the historical ties between Russia and America, and I'm talking about, you know, promoting Russian culture, where does that cross the line to being, you know, a foreign agent activity or espionage light? And I think that's a really important dimension to all these cases. Butina is a great example of this as well. It's all fine and good if you want to make friends and talk about how great Russian culture is, and you want to have lawmakers from Russia talking to lawmakers from the United States and cultural diplomacy, educational diplomacy, that's all fine and good there. But at one point when you're taking guidance from Russia's premier, you know, domestic intelligence service, that kind of would seem to me like to cross the line. And
is that what courts look for? They look for the ties to institutions? Because I assume, you know, it'd be possible to, like, just on a civic level, you're like trying to network, and you might even be, you know, you might even be documenting rigorously, like, who's on your side. I mean, like, you could build an archive of stuff like this on your own, I imagine. But is it when you're actually interacting and receiving orders, essentially, from like a police agency, that's kind of the threshold that the legal system looks for?
I guess so. I mean, that's a question for the Justice Department's
sure.
National Security Division, who charges these type of things.
But, and the judges who rule on them, I suppose.
And the judges as well. But, you know, the Foreign Agent Registration Act was front and center after 2016 in the first Trump administration and then into the Biden administration. And, you know, all these people were roped up with a foreign agent with FARA. Paul Manafort being most famous of them all there, who briefly worked as the campaign manager for Donald Trump during the first administration campaign. And there was some concern from a lot of people in Washington that the Justice Department was being heavy-handed in how it was choosing to prosecute FARA cases. And I think with the advent of, with the advent of the second Trump administration, and there's been, I think, a notable downgrading of efforts to prosecute these sorts of cases. But,
right.
I mean, the Foreign Agent Act is pretty clear. The American Foreign Agent Act. The Russian Foreign Agent Act is a whole different Naked Pravda podcast episode there. It's a doozy.
Sure.
And as people know, it is wholly incorrect to draw a direct parallel between the two laws. But again, to get back to my original point, what Zurbin was saying is, where does that cross the line? Does Butina, you know, talking to Republicans and gun rights activists in Washington, and that's all fine and good, but she was doing that at the guidance of this Russian senator, Alexander Torchin, who's a notorious character in Russian government politics. So it's an interesting question that also grabbed me about the Zarubina case. Is where does it cross? When does it cross the line? And I guess it is when you have a cell phone that gets searched by the FBI, and they're like, "Oh, here you were communicating with the FSB Second Division for Constitutional Protection about talking to Joe Schmo and cultivating him for future, you know, purposes."
Thanks for listening, folks. That's this week's show. As always, check out Meduza's homepage for our reporting on Russia, Ukraine, and the surrounding region. Share this podcast with your friends and enemies if you want. Write a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're tuning in. Until next time.